But let's look first at Ephesians 6:1. Many people know this. A few weeks ago, I was listening to Doug talk. I think it was in Seattle. You probably heard him say it. The three verses he memorized early in life. Not because he tried to memorize them. One of them was, be sure your sin will find you out. Another one was, be kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another. And the third one was, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Now, the reason he had memorized that is because it had been said to him so many times. Your sin will find you out. Oh, there's another one. Out of the abundance of the mouth, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. When one of the kids would say something that wasn't really kind, Bess would say, that's what your heart's like. That's where it came from. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Most of us know Ephesians 6:1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. But very few know the second verse. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. How many of you have ever been exasperated by your father? Anybody? A few, okay. How many of you have exasperated your children? Okay, now, your father was wrong according to this text, and you were wrong when you... It says, fathers, do not exasperate your children. And over in chapter 3 of Colossians, it says, fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. Fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. So one is, do not exasperate them, and do not embitter them, and you do not want discouraged children. The subject tonight is devotions for small children. Or for the first hour. Before you have the content of the devotion, whether it be books or the Bible or prayer or singing, and we'll talk about each of those, there is something else that is very important in the devotion. And that is very much warmth. That which makes the devotion effective is the atmosphere of the family, the atmosphere of the home. If the kids are screaming at each other, and if husband and wife are nagging each other, and yet say, okay, knock it all off, we're going to have our family devotion. The atmosphere isn't there. What you want is an atmosphere of warmth. You can do all the right things and not have it have the effect. Before your children can understand what you're reading, don't even know what the pictures are, in your family devotion, you should have as many of them on your lap as you can squeeze. If you got one, you have one, of course. If you have two, you have two in your lap. If you have three, you have three in your lap. If you have four, you have four in your lap. Because not only is it being close to father or close to mother, it's being close to each other. There's a real togetherness. And the children, it uses the word, bring them up in the training and instruction. The King James says the nurture and admonition. And nurture is tender feeding. It's sort of like a nursing mother. But after the child is beyond nursing, he's not beyond cuddling. He's not beyond that same kind of... You can teach all kinds of evil things if you did it with cuddling. You can teach anything false if you did it with warmth. They just accept it. This is why so many people like Santa Claus, because it's also done with warmth. Or sometimes. So it's a sense of nurture, which is sort of tender feeding. It's not just that you feed the person, but you feed them in a way that is the inward today is bonding. And what you want is a close bond. Then when you are reading to the children, or praying with the children, or singing to the children, they make that connection, that association. That this, these things go together. And when they get older, they have a nostalgia about it. And they'll look back. What a wonderful time. They won't look back and say, boy, my parents crammed the Bible down my throat. Oh, every night we had Bible reading, and what a drag. And, you know, if you do it with the atmosphere, they don't come up with that kind of answer. One time when our children were small, probably preschool, maybe just in school, Doug was just in school, Bessie was talking with the next door neighbor, Pastor Back Fans, whose 15-year-old daughter had just gotten pregnant. And the mother said, well, what years could become teenagers, you know? And you'll have a rough time too. So the conversation ended, and Bessie saw that Douglas had been listening to the conversation. And she said, well, Douglas, what do you recommend? What do you recommend that we not have this problem when you become a teenager? Well, he said, you know, sometimes when we're in Washington, D.C., and we come home late, we skip the Bible reading. I don't think we ought to do that. Okay, but it may be very Douglas, but maybe that's why Douglas is very Douglas now. It's not just projecting backwards. It wasn't an unhappy time. So I want to put a heavy emphasis on the atmosphere, so that all sins are taken care of by mother and by father before the Bible reading. So they are spiritually ready for it. And if you can do it together, do it together. Do not pull this stunt. Father has devotions while mom is washing up the dishes. Just don't do it. It's a temptation, or mom will have the devotions with the kids why dad is doing something else. We call that redeeming the time, but what it really is breaking the atmosphere. We're saying to the children, this is important, but it's not that important. It's important, but there's something more important. So when you have your family time together, have it together. And the only reason not to have it together is if one of you is out of town or, you know, just physically can't do it. You put a priority on it, so it's a whole family together. Now, our problem wasn't so much other things. Our problem was this. We generally had two readings. We had a Bible reading or a Bible story reading, and then we had one other reading, either Jungle Doctor or Chronicles of Narnia or a missionary story or something. We'd have two readings, a chapter from the book and a chapter from something else. And we had a good something else's. And as soon as Doug could read, he was not willing to wait till tomorrow night for the next chapter. And neither was Bessie. So we had two violators, Bessie and Douglas, wanting to get the book and finish it that night, and then being less interested in the chapter the next night. But that was a good kind of interest. What you do not want is something boring. And you can have the atmosphere that's warm and kind and loving and still be a drag, because you're just boring with it. And so one of the things you want to be sure is that you're excited about what you're doing. If you're not excited about what you're doing, then get excited about what you're doing, so the excitement picks up. With younger children, they don't mind if, in fact, they prefer the same story over and over again. You probably knew this. Again, it doesn't have to be Bible, it doesn't have to be Christian. Because what you're doing is establishing this relationship, and if your relationship is with God, then the rest of their life, they're going to check with you about the relationship with God. One of the stories that Gordon liked was Rikki Tikki Tavi. I don't know, have you read it? Kipling's book on the mongoose? And they've had a movie of it, and they've had a picture book, Walt Disney kind of picture book. We get the real thing. But I'd probably only read it to him once a year. But even though it was once a year, I would periodically change a word or skip a word. And he'd nail me. He had it memorized. So it may be a drag to you to read the same Arch book over and over again to your children, but that also provides security to the child. The security of sameness that they like. And you can expand, but once you get bored, and you will probably will. You want to somehow keep excited about this same old stuff. Okay, I mentioned several things that we do. The reading, well, first the atmosphere, second the excitement, third the reading of the word, and the reading of something else. And then singing. One of the big temptations today that we have is with tape recorders. Children like music, and they like to hear the same thing over and over again, so you just put the tape in and go do the dishes, and they listen to it. Well, I'm not saying that's wrong, but it's not the same thing as mother singing. You say, but Michael W. Smith does it a lot better, or whoever sings to these little kids. And also, if you sing, you can teach them a broader spectrum of songs. One of the great hymns of the faith is a hymn called "And Can It Be That I Should Gain?" Do you know it? By Charles Wesley. Oh, I think at one time when Gordon must have been 14 years old, so it was 14 years ago, he said, "Dad, would you sing me to sleep?" Now, what do I want to say? You're too old to be sung to sleep. That's what you want to say, and because I want to do something else. He's old enough to go to bed. But he didn't say that. I said, "Sure. Sure. I'll be glad to sing it to sleep. What will it be?" He said, "And can it be?" Now, what was he saying? He said, "Dad, I've got wonderful memories of you singing me to sleep with 'And Can It Be' when I was a little baby. And I'd like to do it again." But he's 14 years old, but he's not an adult. He's still a little kid. And sometimes we just, we should keep providing the security. An awful lot of kids grew up without enough. It doesn't mean their parents do not love them. It just means the parents think it's just normal. You know, everything's normal, everything's okay. So, you know, why spend the extra effort? Sing to the kids. After you read and sing, Then if you want to put something on the tape recorder, fine. That means they can, I know of, not recently, but maybe a year ago, I was over at Doug and Nancy's house, and the two girls wanted music in their room, and Nathan wanted the NIV Book of Revelation. And he'd go to sleep with the NIV on, and the girls would go to sleep with music. But it wasn't in place of their time. It was additional, and it was at their request. When you pray, you also want to pray with them, and pray for each of them, and pray for everything of interest to them, in addition to all of their interests. And then pray for family interests so that they can be participants in answered prayer for the family. You don't want to communicate anxiety or worry or things like that to your children. But if it's the right kind of prayer, it won't be communicating anxiety or worry. It'll just be communicating, this is what we do. One day, we were coming back from an event at Russell School. So Gordon must have been in the fifth or sixth grade. And his best friend was Paul Beveridge, who was the son of the Episcopalian rector, pastor. And so we were coming back as if two families walking back from this parent-teacher thing or something. And the pastor, Bob Beveridge, he said, can I tell you something funny or something like that? I said, sure. He said, well, Gordon was over at our house for dinner, which happened fairly regularly, you know, back and forth kids. And Paul Beveridge and Bill Beveridge were kids who were out delivering papers, working, doing everything to get extra cash. And Paul was always leaning on Gordon to get a job. And at this dinner, he was pushing Doug, I was pushing Gordon, he said, get a job. Why don't you get a job? He was fifth grade or sixth grade. So. What do you do for money? Oh, Gordon said, whenever we need money, we get around the dining room table and pray. So the thing is, he said this at the Episcopalian pastor's house, and the pastor thought that was so funny that he wanted to pass it on to me. Okay, well, it happened to be true, you know, but he entered into it. I mean, this is what you did. So, we have a piano that we prayed for 15 months around the dinner table. And one day we got a telephone call from a piano company saying, we got a new piano for you. Can we deliver it tomorrow? And, who ordered it? Oh, we got a check from 1,000 miles away, said deliver a piano to this address. So we tried to think of who might have been at our dinner table sometime when we were praying, you know. And it was one of the things that caused Barbara Friedman to become a Christian, because she was there when the piano arrived. You know? But you let your children, so when you pray with the children, you pray for each of them, you pray for all of their interests, their little interests, whatever they are, and then you pray for family interests. And they identify, they become part of. And sometimes they end up with more faith than you have, because they'll trust. In fact, they'll rebuke you. They'll chew you out when they see a little bit of anxiety here or there. And they say, hey, I thought you said we were supposed to trust your, you know, mom or dad or, and it's happened to me more than once. Sometimes we didn't let it happen, we just asked them to lead in prayer. And they would pray in faith and it would happen. The atmosphere, the excitement, the Word of God, something else, it doesn't have to, it might be secular, it might be Christian, but something else that's part of the family, singing, and prayer. Also, when, now you can have this after supper, which I think is a good time, or you can have it when they're all in their pajamas. And I think we generally did it when they were all in their pajamas, they'd had their baths, and so the next event was going to bed. If they have different rooms, then you go in to each room, or if they're in the same room, it doesn't make any difference, but you tuck them each into bed. Normally, we quit tucking children into bed at such an age that as they grew up, they can't remember ever having been tucked into bed. Because we quit before their memory kicks in. So keep it up so it's part of their conscious memory, not just part of their unconscious memory. And then when you're tucking them into bed, since each child is so different from each other, you figured that one out, have you? Maybe some are alike, but normally, it's not just a difference in sex, it's a difference in personality. And one child can be completely distressed about something that's, you had no idea. You couldn't comprehend it. It wouldn't have distressed you, it wouldn't have distressed the other kids, and this child is wiped out. When you tuck him into bed, that's the time to find it out individually. And provide the comfort or the solution. When we first came to town, we started a place called God's Garage. The house has burned down, the garage has been moved. And these were kids from the 10th to the 12th grade who had been in trouble since the 3rd grade. I remember talking to this one girl. She's Heather's age. In fact, I saw her not long ago and she wanted Heather to look her up. I think Heather did look her up. So that was probably when she was 15. And she's 32 now. But this 15-year-old girl told me in the garage that she hated her father. I said, why? She said, well, when I was 5 years old, I fell down in the bathtub and hurt myself and cried. And he told me to stop crying. And if I didn't stop crying, he was going to spank me. And she said, I kept crying and he spanked me. And I didn't stop, and he spanked me again. And she said, I've hated my father ever since. Okay, I'm sure that's not the only reason. But it stood out in her memory. So much so, I didn't bring up that event, but when she came in the store a few months ago, I said, how is it, in the meantime, she's on her second marriage, how is it with your parents? And she said something, it was sort of positive, you know, well, we've taken care of a lot of the problems. Didn't say much. That sort of thing, if it ever happened, and you should be alert enough to pick up on it and take care of it before it, you know, builds. And sometimes, I used bedtime as a time of making things right with the children when I overcorrected. Overcorrected or was super impatient or something like that. And they've told me later that what they hated most of all was for me to come in and sit on their feet and confess my sins. Now, it just keeps the barriers down. And it's the kind of thing that causes the children to confess. I remember one time after Gordon was grown up, he's dead. He said, "When I was little, you told me that if I did something wrong," he said, "sooner or later you'd find out anyhow." He said, "You just said that you'd catch up with me somehow." He said, "You didn't." He said, "I did things wrong, you didn't catch up. And I kept expecting you to catch me, you didn't catch me. And then I had to come and confess it to you." Well, I said, "I did find out." Okay, now, what you want is an openness. Now, after the children get a little bit older, now this is supposed to be for small children, and so I put the emphasis upon the atmosphere, the security, and the different things you did within that framework: pray, sing, read, and talk with them individually about problems they have. But as they get a little bit older and become a little bit more independent and have more friends and play other places, you want to keep this relationship. You establish it very early. You don't let it break. A lot of times we think we have it continually going. And then one of our children gets in the junior high and it looks like we don't have it still going. Well, probably we didn't have it for a year or two prior to that. But they didn't have enough rebellion in them to let you know at that age. So they waited till they got old enough to, you know, pull it off. But it probably didn't happen when they were junior high, and we like to think that's when it happened. And that's not when it happens. It's been happening. And they just get an adolescence and with other adolescents, and they encourage to express some of the things that they've been feeling. So in that independent, in between years, like the fourth, fifth, and sixth grades, it takes a little bit more conscious creative action. With a little child, you don't have to be real creative. I said they want the same thing over and over again anyhow. You know, but as you get in the fourth, fifth, and sixth grades, you should be a little bit more creative. And when it comes to understanding, do not treat them like they were little kids. They are very capable of understanding great truths and big words. You know, unless they have a learning disability of some kind. But if they don't have a learning disability, do not talk down to the children. And you can get right to the Bible instead of a Bible storybook. And you can go through it with real thinking. In other words, you can have a Bible study together, not just a devotion. And they learn how to see the text. And they're excited about it. Bessie did this with the neighborhood kids. These weren't devotions, but this is a Bible study group. It wasn't a good news club, it wasn't child evangelism, but it was that kind of thing, except she wasn't pushing for decisions to receive Jesus. And she took them through the Acts of the Apostles and the journeys of Paul, and these were all pre-junior high. And so everybody knew everything. The kids got to junior high, she said, "Jim, I can't have two groups. You take one of them." Well, I didn't know anything about junior high kids, except I had, and suddenly had one. And what do I do? Kids like to do. Well, from my observation, they like to fool around. they like to mess around, fool around. I said, "All right, that's the first thing we'll do. We'll have 30 minutes of fooling around." And what's the next thing junior high kids like to do? Eat, right? Okay, So we just planned 30 minutes of fooling around and 30 minutes of eating. Okay, now, then, having flipped the fooling around out of them and the eating out of them, then we had an hour Bible study. So every Wednesday afternoon, we had 30 minutes of buck-buck or keep-away or frisbee or touch football or something like that. We had about 20 junior high kids, boys and girls, and we just ran wild for 30 minutes. And then we fed them for 30 minutes. And then we had Bible study for an hour. And at that time, I said, what do you want to study? Well, I don't know, we'd gone through several books. And they said, we'd like to study Revelation. I said, okay. Okay. I said, I'll take three of you and you'll be leaders. I'll teach you how. I said, no speculation, no guessing. You're going to study what it says, and that's what you do. No guessing. We're going to find out what it says. So I taught these three how to ask questions to the text to find out what it said. And broke them into three groups with the three leaders. And they went through the book of Revelation, and I went upstairs and read a Life magazine. They were looking at the book. If I'd been down there, they'd ask me what it meant all the time. I didn't know what it meant. What we're doing is getting people to study the Word. And the excitement is there. So you can do it with almost any age group. So when they're small, you provide the security. Now, there's something else. After the two older boys went, we had that for 3 years. And then we moved to Ann Arbor, and I decided I'd teach the high school Sunday school class because Doug and Evan were in there. So was Tom Garfield and Judy Garfield. So Tom can't say a whole lot. But anyhow, something came up. I was the charge of evangelism for one of the Billy Graham movies that came to town. So I just took the whole high school class through the evangelism concert class. And so they're all counselors at Billy Graham. In fact, did the same thing out here when we had one in Moscow. And I think Heather was 16. She is now a counselor, and I'd given the invitation. And she said, Dad, she said, I'm willing to counsel somebody. Just give me a junior high girl or a little girl or something like that. Gave the invitation at night, and there were no little kids come down, a lot of adults. And Heather came down to be a counselor, and she didn't find any little girls. So she saw this a tall woman with long straight black hair in jeans, and so she went up beside her to counsel her. And he wasn't a tall girl, it was a Cheyenne male Indian. So the first person she led to the Lord was a Cheyenne Indian. But what you do is you bring the kids along with you. And I wanted to get to, then when Heather was in junior high, I took the junior high group. And when Gordon got in junior high, I started junior high Bible study here in town. And what happened here with the junior high study, I would ask questions. I can't remember the numbers, but I said, how many kids are Christians in the junior high? That was the funniest question they'd heard. Everybody laughed. I said, you mean nobody talks like Christians? No. I said, 5%? No way. No, 1%? Yeah, maybe. I said, but look at all the Nazarene kids go to that junior high, and all the Grace Baptist Church go to the junior high, and from the other evangelical churches, there ought to be a lot of Christians in the junior high. What's the vocabulary at junior high? And they all laugh again. I said, you mean people are... talk differently at junior high than they do at home? Well, yeah. I said, do you talk differently? Well, the funny part about these questions, Gordon was in the class. And the other kids would say, if we tell you, are you going to tell our parents? I said, no, I have no reason to tell your parents. But then it suddenly occurred to him that Gordon was speaking up like the rest of them, and I was his parent. And they said, how can you do that? Gordon, how can you talk that way in front of your father? Because he wasn't hiding. I say, how many kids in the junior high? And I don't know what they said. Maybe it was back east, but the name 600 sticks in my head, but I know there can't be 600 kids here in the junior high, but yeah. I said, 600, and 1% is Christian. That means six. I said, there are seven of you are here. Which one of you is not the Christian? Okay. What you want to do is talk to your children in such a way that they know that you've heard these words before. Now they think, the words that are said at the junior high school, mom and dad never heard before. And no sense in, they just, mom and dad just don't understand. Now I'm not saying you should use these words with the kids, but you should somehow, without confessing all of your own awful past, you should let them know that you've been some of the places that they're going through now. And when you do, the kids will stay open with you. I mentioned earlier, your children are different. And I suppose Gordon is the most open with it, you know, with this. But they're all different. You know, so I'm not assuming that if they weren't open, they were hiding something. I never made that kind of assumption. But what you want to do is so they feel free to talk with you. We'll talk in the next hour a little bit more on teenagers, but you want to keep the communication open, and when it's open and secure, then you never have rebellion. They just don't do it. And I say it, since most of you here know our four children. And they are not unopinionated. They're not, weak people. And you think that normally, if they're that strong-willed, they would have given all kinds of, requests for independence or going their own way, and they just never did. I won't say never did, but it was just, I guess I could say never did. I won't say there wasn't a disobedience here or there or something like that, but it just wasn't any rebellion. And that didn't mean they agreed with me or I agreed with them. It just meant that we just stayed in fellowship. But it starts early. And I'll say it another way, which had, since we're primarily on devotions, I did bring a stack of devotion books here that you can look at. Some of them we've used. I talked about the security and the atmosphere. The primary responsibility for atmosphere in the home is a relationship between husband and wife. That sets the atmosphere. Any strained atmosphere between the husband and wife, the kids pick up so fast it isn't funny. And if it's beyond strain, like yelling or things like that, the kids go into trauma. And they cry themselves to sleep or they don't know what's going on. And children adjust, but that's all you can say is they manage to adjust. They're survivors. It doesn't mean they adjust properly. So the major thing on the atmosphere is a relationship between husband and wife. The next thing on the atmosphere is, do not divide your love up between the children. Do not divide the love up between your children. When you have the one, when you have one, you give this one an awful lot of attention. When number two comes along, and you think you've got a fixed amount of time, then you give 50% to each. And both end up hurting. Number one, because he's not getting what he used to get. Number two doesn't know the difference, but he's not getting enough. And then when number three comes along, then they have even less time from each other. That's just, if you don't think about it, that's what will happen naturally. You may not let it, you must not let it happen naturally. You give 100% to all three. You keep giving 100% to number one, you give 100% to number two, and 100% to number three. You don't have any higher priority in your life. Other than original sin and just the basic sinfulness of little children, which you probably notice early in life, other than that, we as parents enhance that inherent tendency to rebel by not giving enough attention and affection. What I mean is this. When you're not giving enough, each of the children thinks that the other one's getting more than he's getting. The major cause for sibling rivalry is not enough tension from parents. They're jealous. Have you ever noticed when you, for whatever reason, you give some special attention to one of the children, the other one came rushing up and tried to squeeze in between or get some extra? Because it needed it. You say, but they'd always do that. No, you can saturate them. You can give them so much, they'll say, Mom, lay off. I got things to do. If they're still asking for attention, now the more if you're giving them enough, they will not be in rivalry with their brother or sister. Now, I shouldn't say that absolutely. I say, until they're Christians and growing, they will not. They'll be very supportive of each other. Defend each other. So by giving enough attention, you knock off all the fights. Or you cut them down a lot anyhow. Also, it's easier to give attention to the one who is sweet and was born that way. And the other one was born just with a bad attitude. just came out whining. Complaining about something. And it's just harder to give the loving attention to the complainer. And it's easy to give it to the one who knows how to ask for it. So the one who knows how to ask for it gets more, and the other one gets the back of your hand for the way he's acting. Evan's two children were born very differently. Davis didn't have a good attitude about life or about anything, and Michael was kind of happy from the start. Well, when you're grandparents and you're in the same town, and it's easy to be critical of what's happening. Well, you can correct me because you probably know more than I do, but. But they turned that little boy around. Now, he still kept it up for a year or two, but they turned him around. One is they never let him get away with it, and they didn't get irritated. Wouldn't I get, but they didn't get irritated. But yeah, I would. One time I was noticing, I said, Evan, I took him out to lunch one time. I said, Evan, have you ever gotten impatient with your children? He said, not that I can remember. Okay. Turn the little boy around so he gets some sort of commendation for being the best example in the first grade. Well, if they'd he'd been up for merit badges when he was 1 year old, he wouldn't have made it. Okay. You give the security, the attention, and the discipline, but you don't react. In other words, you don't act, you don't do what you feel like. Because you might be in bad sorts, and you don't want to communicate to children the way you're feeling, you communicate the way they need. The more love you give to a child, the more love, the more attention, the more secure the baby is, the more secure the child is. You know that, you know, you don't have to listen to me. You know if you have a happy pregnancy, the baby is healthier sociologically. You know the same thing in the early years of life. But the more you give, and you expect to do it when the baby's that small. But as soon as the baby's 2 years old and can walk and talk, then you don't want to give it the attention. Why? Because he's demanding attention all the time. He grabs you the pants and says, Mom, 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 for 10 hours. Now you can say, you know, go play in the traffic. Or, you know, you could do everything. You can say, I'm busy, I'm doing the dishes. What this child wants is undivided attention. And mothers don't want to give undivided attention. They want to give attention while they're doing something else. And you can't fool the kid. He knows he's not getting any attention. So he keeps after it. And it's not just with Mom, he's with Dad. Dad comes home and gets in front of the box and turns it on, and little kid says, Dad. And he says, what? Keeps looking at the box. Dad, what? Dad, what? I said, what? What's he want? He wants you to look at him. Well, when you're speaking to him and he's looking the other way, what do you say to him? You say, look at me. Now, why do you say, look at him? Because you know his ears are parallel to his eyes. And if he's looking at you, you got his attention. He wants your attention. When you give him attention, you've just cut out hearing him say Dad 4 times. Give it to him the first time. You say, but I'm waiting for the Yankee score. Something important, I gotta know. Or it's a newspaper. Give your child attention. When you give attention, you just cut down all of this demand. If they demand it, it's because they need it. Now we know it when they're babies, but we don't believe it when they're 2. And we certainly don't believe it when they're 15. But they still need it. The more secure they are with both sexes of parents, both sexes of children, with much security from both sexes of parents, when they get into adolescence, they will be attracted to the opposite sex, but they won't need the opposite sex. They'll be attracted, but they won't need. What I mean by that, you can, if you remember back in that day, in junior high and high school, there'd be kids glommed onto each other, latched onto each other, come down the hall. Not getting any love at home, think this is love, needing this security. And other kids also attract the opposite sex, but they're not doing that because they're not starved for it. So you give enough, you don't have to do a lot of teaching against them. You can still teach your children, treat your children like they're little kids. Up in their teenagers, because they're still little kids. And they grow up secure and mature. And so if they don't have a girlfriend, they don't have a boyfriend, there's no tragedy. They're very happy. So when the right time comes along, it's normal and secure. And even with most of the things I'm saying tonight, I learned late. I came from a family that was not demonstrative, not affectionate, and I wasn't. Not only was I not, but I spent 11 years in the Navy. I expected the kids to snap to, and they didn't, you know, and then I'd get irritated. They hadn't gone through boot camp. They didn't know they were supposed to, you know, do things right away. I had to change. And so, I'm not saying I did things right, but I can see after the fact that even when I came on late doing things right, it wasn't too late. Well, we've got an hour. Let's take a break.